WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What comic book writer would pass up the opportunity to write Superman? The answer is my guest, Steven Siegel. After resisting, he eventually gave in and spent a year writing stories for the Man of Steel. His new book is a graphic novel based on that experience called It's a Bird. The paradox at the center of the story is that as Siegel writes for a hero who has inherited superpowers, he's haunted by Huntington's disease, a hereditary illness that killed his grandmother and his aunt that he may or may not carry. Siegel has also written the comics Uncanny X-Men, House of Secrets, Sandman Mystery Theater, and Vertigo. Steven Siegel, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to read a passage from your new graphic novel, It's a Bird. And this is the part in which you, may I use the word you, are on the phone?
Sure. It's like me.
Yes,
it's
okay.
It's me-ish.
Good. So you or you-ish is on the phone with your editor, and he's trying to talk you into writing Superman comics. And his name, the editor's name, is Jeremy. Would you read it?
Sure. I can't, Jer. Sorry, it's not working for me. I'm not the man for this job. I've been thinking it over, and the pieces don't add up. You know, the costume, the secret identity, the origin. Superman doesn't hold water in the real world. Jeremy makes this face every time he's plotting out how to contradict everything I've just said. And he says, you don't work in the real world. You work in fantasy. It doesn't need to be logical. Just take the costume for granted. He has the costume. And the secret identity, don't tell me that's not believable. Everybody's got secrets. I've got some. Don't you? Look, you don't have to reconcile every piece of his history. But I tell him, I like things to be believable. For me to write Superman, I have to believe he could live in our world, but he can't. Everything about him is ludicrous. Even that mantra, faster than a speeding locomotive, more powerful than a bullet, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird. He cuts me off. You've got the mantra wrong. Don't expect to understand Superman if you haven't done your homework. I don't accept your refusal. Here, read these. Then come back to me. You won't say no. He gives me a stack of Superman comics. I know it's a challenge, but what Jeremy doesn't know is that I will win. I'll take Superman head on. We'll see who's stronger.
And that's Steven Siegel reading from his new autobiographical graphic novel, It's a Bird. So, Steven, you really did turn down Superman, huh?
I did.
Initially.
But the book is semi-autobiographical, so the facts are all right. They're just all in the wrong order.
And what made you decide to actually do it after all?
Well, I wrote this book, which contains 20 short stories that kind of dissect everything spectacular about Superman, but still find him holding up to anything I can throw at him. And I thought, that's a pretty strong character. You know, if I can really deconstruct him and still find him to be a powerful figure iconically, then maybe I should try to take him on. So when the offer actually did come through, I did a year on the actual Superman comic.
Now let's get to your graphic novel. The great paradox in this story is that you've been asked to write about the Man of Steel, the man who is invulnerable to everything except kryptonite. But you're feeling quite vulnerable, and your family is quite vulnerable because a couple of people in your family have died of Huntington's disease, a disease of the nervous system, which is very, very, very bad and very disabling, and it's inherited.
Correct.
So
yeah.
The question is, who's going to get it next in the family? So the paradox is, as you're about to consider drawing a superhero, you're thinking about how vulnerable your family is to this genetic disease. Did you always see Superman in terms of that paradox?
Well, when I got into writing comic books, I didn't start with superheroes. I started more with crime comics and kind of noir mysteries. And so the superhero paradox didn't occur to me initially because I wasn't working on these super powerful characters. But when I actually did start thinking about them, it was right at the time that my aunt, Sarah, was really going through the final stages of Huntington's, and it did become an ironic juxtaposition that, you know, I'm writing characters who can do anything, and here's a woman who, you know, one week loses the power to swallow, and, you know, another week no longer can speak anymore, and it really just started to weigh heavily on me that what I was supposed to write was a fantasy that was so detached from this reality that I was looking at.
And, you know, some people would take comfort in the fact that there is such a fantasy of invulnerability to fall back on at a time when you're feeling most vulnerable. And for other people, that fantasy would seem useless and pointless and almost make you angry.
I'm told on occasion that I'm too logical about things. And I think that if I looked at it emotionally initially, I would have said, this is a great escape, which is what comic books are in America. One of the reasons why they deal so exclusively with power fantasy is that that's an escape for people who feel powerless. You know, kids in school reading comic books are looking to be stronger than they are looking to be super. And that's the emotional registration. But I think I was looking at them logically because I was writing them as a vocation. And so I just started tearing him apart. I thought, let's just tear down everything that makes Superman super. And as it turned out, he could stand up to anything I could throw at him.
You write about what a really terrible and tragic ending you come to if you have Huntington's disease. And the character is saying this when he is seeing his aunt dying of it. He says, there's no good thing to hope for a Huntington's patient. If you hope they're fine except for the body, you're condemning them to a life sentence lived out inside a useless shell. If you hope they're vegetative and mentally gone, then you've condemned them to a meaningless living death. What did you think about your aunt when you actually saw her dying? What were you hoping that she was experiencing or not experiencing?
Well, we went through, as a family, a lot of different stages with her. She was in a rest home out here in California for just many, many years. And there was a time where people didn't want to go visit her because it was very difficult to look at her and think that could be any one of us next. And when we finally, you know, mustered up the courage to get over that, which we definitely should have, then I started thinking about, well, what should I hope for her? You know, do I hope that she dies soon? Do I hope that she hangs on so that she doesn't die? And that was what I came to, is that there was not really a good alternative for me to hope for, because on the one hand, she was completely incapacitated. And I became obsessed with whether she could understand anything I was saying to her, because the disease causes the neurons in your brain to misfire. And so one of the symptoms of that is a kind of uncontrolled movement. And so you would say something and she would move and you wouldn't know if that was a response to what you were saying or just her brain playing tricks on her. And it really became a dichotomy of just, you know, do I hope that she dies soon or do I hope that she keeps living? And neither one seemed like a good thing.
There's a scene in your graphic novel in which you as a boy overhear your father saying that if he really knew about Huntington's disease in the family and if he knew that it could be passed on, he wouldn't have had children. Did you ever overhear your father say something like that?
The book is semi-autobiographical, and that part is more autobiographical than not. Again, it's, you know, the way that it's staged in the book takes place over a week, and the story of my life takes place over my entire life. So the book, I think, makes it look a little more crass and calculated than it was. But there were conversations like that where my parents would talk to other parents and wouldn't know that my brother and I were still awake and, you know, eavesdropping, which we shouldn't have been. And we would overhear things like this. And I, you know, the thing that the book really helped me with was that I understand why they say that. And the book, if nothing else, is, you know, a laurel to my parents that says, thank you anyway. You know, I don't care if I come down with this fatal disease, anything might come to get me. I really appreciate my life and the way it's turned out and the things that I've done. But I know that it's just been a heavy weight on them, you know, all along, this thought of that they might have damned their own children, which is a terrible thing to have to consider.
And are you considering having children?
It depends. I mean, we're in a different world now. There are genetic tests that can determine whether you are carrying the gene or not. My own father is over 70 now and didn't inherit Huntington's. So, you know, I could certainly confirm if I decided to have children with my very significant other, Liesl Reinhardt, we could have that test and, you know, be able to determine whether it was even a risk or not, which is kind of a great thing. It's certainly not something that was available to my parents. But Nancy Wexler, a doctor, you know, isolated the gene and came up with this test. And even she was on NPR, I think, a week ago on All Things Considered, talking about, you know, having come up with a test, didn't know if she should get it or not. Who wants to know?
My guest is Steven Siegel. His new graphic novel is called It's a Bird. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is comic book writer Steven Siegel. He spent a year writing Superman comics. As he was writing about a superhero, he was thinking about his family's vulnerability to the hereditary disease Huntington's disease. It killed his aunt and his grandmother. So your experiences have really taught you that your body can turn against you, that you can inherit great strengths, but you can also inherit a deadly vulnerability. Have you tried to work ideas like that into your Superman stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing in the world Huntington's did for me was serve as a wake-up call, which is just to say that you have no idea what's going to get you. And it's, you know, it's a tired saying, but people really don't embrace it to the degree that they need to. Anything might get me. You know, I'm at risk for heart disease just because I'm a male. But you don't know if you're going to develop something or not. You really have to live in the moment. You have to live in a way that is consistent with your happiness. You really have to grab the things that you want out of life while you can, because you don't know what your genes or fate or whatever has in store for you the day after tomorrow. So that part of wish fulfillment really does impact the work that I've done on superheroes, and that I think they represent an ideal of living well. And I don't think there is any other lesson in life except live well. Do well by yourself, do well by others, and you're not going to go too wrong. And I think that that is an easy thing to pull out of the superhero mythologies.
But then there's also that point for many people in which that period of your life is over. And from this moment on, you're living with the vulnerability. You're living with the weakness. You're living with a problem that isn't going to go away. Has that sense ever entered your superhero comics? I mean, does that maybe not belong in there, or have you given it to other characters?
Well, it's certainly something that plays out in the non-genre stuff. You know, superheroes, I'm of two minds about. I think that comics, in a global sense, have matured a lot, and in the United States, they've really rested more in the superhero camp, which I think is unfortunate. There are lots of great works out that are not superhero-centered. So I think it's tough then for people to accept that there are headier themes, which is one of the great things about doing this book, in that it combines kind of mature adult themes and sensibilities with an iconic superhero character like Superman, and says, look, this story can still work. I mean, I think it's a comic book that most people wouldn't think to themselves as a comic book when they're done, hopefully. And I don't say that to blow my own horn. I say it to show the flexibility of this medium there. You can do a lot of things. That said, I always think to myself that mostly superhero comics are for kids, and I don't want to bum their high. You know, I want them to have great, fun stories, you know, of superheroes. I do remember when I was growing up, Captain Marvel, the Marvel Comics character, died of cancer. And I was like, what? You know, it was revelatory, but it was, and there was nothing super about it. He just succumbed to cancer and he wasted away, and that was that. And it was kind of a watershed comic book for back in the day.
How'd you feel about that? Did you feel like cheated or angry?
You know, I came from a Huntington's family, so I felt like, hooray, Captain Marvel died of something noble.
That's the thing. There's always going to be at least one kid out there who wants, he's going to identify with the vulnerability and not the wish fulfillment of the strength.
Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it was a great story at the time. I knew he was heroic and I understood what happened to him. And it's just the way the story is told. Mm-hmm, so long as mm-hmm. the facts are put out there, I think kids can understand a lot more than we give them credit for. I know that the It's a Bird book has made it into some teen library collections, which I think is great. I think a teen that's a reader would get this book and not have any trouble with it.
In the year that you were writing Superman, did you do anything to address the kind of problems that you explained earlier that you had, like his secret identity, the silly costume, all the things about Superman that initially made you think that you couldn't really write for him?
I'm sure things like that found their way through the year of work that I did. But to be honest, I had really purged myself by doing this book right before that. And so most of that year, I spent just trying to take Superman for what he was, you know, a hero. Kind of like the editor says, he has the costume, he has the secret identity. So I just tried to accept that. Whether I succeeded or not, you know, is up to the fans, as it always is.
When you agreed to do Superman, were you presented with a list of rules or standards, with a Bible, as they call it, in TV sitcom land, that tells you what the character can do, what he can't, what about other characters, you know, the guidelines for the story?
Well, one of the cool things about our industry is that most of the people who work in it are comic book fans. So a lot of that, it's assumed that you know his rogues gallery and that you know his powers. And more than that, it's assumed that you will try to find new ways to use those powers and those characters. We did have a big meeting just to sit down and talk about where he was at the time and where he was going in the future and, you know, things we might do to make the character as interesting as possible. The coolest thing I would say, though, is that when I came to DC with the idea to do the It's a Bird book with Teddy Christensen, who's the artist on it, a fabulous painter who lives in Copenhagen, I said, this is not going to be at all what you know about this character. It's going to really do some different things with him, and it's going to push into some maybe uncomfortable territory, and here's why I want to do it, and here's how I want to do it. And without batting an eye, they said, absolutely, do it. And I think that that's a testament to the character. You know, Superman is strong enough and flexible enough that you can really do a lot of things to him, with him, for him. And he just keeps standing. He's been around since 1938, and nothing I can do is going to stop that.
What are some of the changes you wanted to make to Superman?
In my book or on the regular comic?
On the regular comic.
I thought it would have been great if he became a parent somehow, and was actually kind of working toward that, but didn't find the way to tell that story well. So I didn't do it, but I thought that would be an interesting change to see how he and Lois Lane, they're married these days. I don't know if you know that or not. And Lex Luthor is president of the United States. My, how Metropolis has changed.
Oh, wait. Lois Lane is a reporter for Action News. You want to talk about change? Yeah, what are some of the other ways, you know, for those of us who haven't been keeping up with Superman, what are some of the other ways the story has changed?
Well, actually, the story is taking a big turn right now. They've just introduced a new creative team on the book that's doing something that, to be honest, I don't even know where it's going. A lot of people on Earth have suddenly vanished, and I don't know if it's the second coming or who knows what. But, you know, the thing about Superman is that he'll have long hair for a while and then they'll make it short again. He'll get different jobs. During my tenure, he got put on the police beat, kind of a demotion, because he was finding corruption in the Lex Luthor presidential campaign re-election stuff. And, you know, just the jobs will change. But the thing that I find most enduring about Superman and most endearing about him also is just that he is so consistent. You know, some people find that to be a limitation. I find it to be really actually quite excellent. There are so few things that you can look at and say, I know exactly what that is. And Superman is that. He's an ideal. He's an iconic standard of goodness and right, which some people think is boring. It's very Boy Scout. But, you know, in a world that's as morally gray as the world I find myself living in, I think it's refreshing that something can represent an ideal that consistently over time.
The creators of Superman were both Jewish. Mm-hmm. And I find that interesting in the sense that, you know, the Clark Kent character, you know, Superman's secret identity as Clark Kent, you know, he's brought up in this, like,
right,
Midwestern family. It's so not Jewish. It seems so...
It's mythic America.
Suppose so, right. It's certainly not the kind of home that the two creators of Superman were probably brought up in.
No, but if you think about it, you know, Siegel and Shuster were very smart in that what they created for Superman was a story of coming from another world and trying to make good in the place where you find yourself, which is the story of so many Jewish immigrants. And that's exactly the story of Superman, who comes from the planet Krypton and goes to Metropolis and tries to make good and do right, you know, and make a name for himself by doing good, solid work and by helping people. So I think that it's a metaphor for, you know, the Jewish immigration into America at the time that they found themselves here.
Did you ever watch Superman on TV?
I watched some of the reruns now and then, but, you know, that was kind of pre-cable, when my parents never would get cable. They were anti-cable. They're still anti-cable. So it was not at my disposal so easily. But I did like the kind of stoicness of it. You know, I remember it as being very, static.
How did the costume look to you on TV versus how it looks in the comics?
Very gray. You know, one of the things that I always find interesting is that when you read about potential movies back when it was Christopher Reeve and the current go-round, that people are always concerned about the costume. You know, how will I look in the costume? But I think it's a great looking costume, you know, by and large, if you're going to dress up in spandex colors, that's the way to go. Because it's a costume that when you look at it, you know what it looks like. You could draw it right after seeing it once, which is, that's tough to do. I wouldn't say that about really any other superheroes.
You said it looked very gray. I mean, Superman is very primary colors, and I'm black and white. Black and white,
yeah,
TV.
I seem to remember it as a black and white show, yeah.
Yeah.
But the logo, that S, which is kind of what begins our book, is just the idea of that stylistic S, you know, that really burned into my mind. And I think that's why the book begins with that, is that when I think of Superman, I just think of that logo, you know, and it's on T-shirts and products and everything. It really has made a mark in the global consciousness.
Jay never thought of it quite that way, that he's like the guy who wears his own logo all the time. He's branded himself.
Absolutely.
Steven Siegel's new graphic novel is called It's a Bird. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with comic book writer Steven Siegel. He wrote Superman comics for a year. His new semi-autobiographical graphic novel, It's a Bird, is based on that year. It's also about his thoughts on the superhero and his own vulnerability. Are there fantasies that you've had over the years that you managed to work into comic stories, Superman or other ones?
Fantasies, you know, again, I'm a literal kind of person, and so really what I tend to work into my work is my life, but my family is really weird. Like, we've had a lot of strange experiences. My dad looks like Richard Nixon and was once mistaken by the Secret Service for him and carted away because they thought Nixon had gotten up. My dad was where Nixon was at the time. It was a graduation at the Air Force Academy, and my dad was working it, and they thought that Nixon had wandered away from the security perimeter. And, you know, we checked into a motel once that had blood under throw rugs, just fresh puddles of blood, you know, just weird things like that. Those things tend to find their way into my work, which is why I felt like at some point Huntington's and the mark that that made on us really had to, even though it's kind of one of the last things I got to.
How did the Nixon story end up in a comic? What was the story? How did you use it?
I didn't use that exact story that way, but just the idea of mistaken identity, you know, I was thinking about some of my earlier comics, that's all over the place in those where people think someone is someone else. But my family has such rich, odd stories that's really played out in my work far more than my own fantasies because so many weird things had happened. And in real life, it played out that as soon as my dad spoke, he doesn't sound anything like Richard Nixon, they knew they had the wrong guy.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it's very strange. Family photos of my family from the... You know, from when I was 2 or 3 years old, is my mom, my dad, my brother, and Richard Nixon.
Did you ever find out whose blood was under the rugs?
You know, that was very troubling, but we were traveling cross-country. My dad won't fly, though he was in the Air Force, which is another strangely ironic juxtaposition. So we would drive, and he would just drive until we, you know, we'd leave North or South Carolina and drive straight through to California. And we were just so tired that we checked into this hotel. And it was the only room that was left. I think we were in San Antonio, in the whole city. We had stopped at every hotel, and they said, here's our last room. And we went in, and my mom at the time had medication overlap kind of before that was diagnosed. So they didn't know, and she was kind of a little edgy all the time. And she looked at the adjoining room door and said, well, I'm not going to sleep because somebody could break in here and kill us just by coming through that door. And my dad said, fine, and he pushed the dresser in front of it, and... Then she said, well, why would there be a throw rug on the floor? You know, you don't put a throw rug on carpet. And she lifted it up, and there was the blood, and we were out of that room and in the car and driving to California. Didn't stay.
Gosh. And how did you use that in a story?
A lot of the comics that I work on are for the Vertigo imprint of DC Comics. This book, the Superman book, It's a Bird, is also for that imprint. But those comics tend to be, you know, more like a PG to an R-rated movie as opposed to a G-rated movie. Comics definitely for an adult audience. And one of the books I worked on was called Sandman Mystery Theater, which was a crime noir set in the 1930s. And so I had a similar discovery of blood in one of those mysteries.
What other comics are you drawing now?
I'm at present working on Encyclopedia Brown, who was the boy detective, doing a graphic novel series of that. And then I'm with Teddy Christensen, the artist on It's a Bird, working on our follow-up project, which we have three things. We haven't settled yet on which one it will be. And then I'm also doing a comic book that's another political thriller, which is kind of the way that I started, called Persona, which is about my neighborhood in Altadena, where I live, and mysterious goings-on.
How did you get matched up with Teddy Christensen, the artist who you collaborate with on It's a Bird, and who you've worked with him on other things as well? The artwork is really beautiful in the book.
The artwork is beautiful. That poor man, I've worked with Teddy for a number of years, and one of the things he always says to me is, challenge me. So when I came up with this idea, I was actually at his house, and he said, what are we going to do next? And I said, I don't know. And moments later, I had the complete book just fly into my head in its totality. And I said, well, Teddy, I now do know what we're going to do. Here's the bad news. It has to be drawn in 20 completely different art styles. And he did that, and not just drew it, but he painted it. You know, one of the cool things about graphic novels is their ability to shift into other art styles. And I don't even know that people looking at this would think, as you were saying, that you didn't know they put names on the cover, but a lot of people don't know that they paint comic books, and this comic book is completely painted in a number of different medium. And I had met Teddy years before at a comic book convention, and it was a very loud, bustling place, and he said that I was the only quiet, calm thing in the room, so he was drawn toward me. We had a conversation and started working together and have been working together ever since. But I really like that he's a European artist, which gives him a kind of a different sensibility. You know, this book is very muted in its tones, except for Superman, who is this kind of red, yellow, blue bolt of lightning that hits the pages.
How do you like the way the artist Teddy Christensen has drawn you for your graphic novel, It's a Bird?
I think I look devastatingly sexy, so I love it. and of course, it's not really me. So if he's got too much of a chin here and there, or hasn't shaved, or looks a little tired, I can always claim it's not really me.
Okay. Steven Siegel, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Steven Siegel's new graphic novel is called It's a Bird.